From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are a couple of hardy perennials, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. Islamic extremists captured Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, and began moving toward Baghdad as units of the Iraqi army collapsed and the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki sought military help from the United States. In Brazil, the 32-team World Cup of Football, or soccer as it's known in the United States, began amid protests in Brazil and new evidence of corruption in the World Federation that governs the sport. And in Washington, Republicans debated how to replace one of its top leaders in Congress, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who lost his seat in a primary election in Virginia. Well, let's start, David Rennie, with Iraq. The things for the Iraqi government and for the United States and the Obama administration that support that government, with some complaints, things couldn't be worse.
Things couldn't be worse. The biggest tragedy and the biggest danger is what is unfolding in Iraq, and we shouldn't lose sight of the, you know, the horrendous, dangerous things that are happening in Iraq. And this isn't just Iraq. This is Iraq and Syria. This is the kind of bleeding together of those two crises. But it's also clear that in Washington, which took too long to kind of wake up to this, it's taken kind of political Washington, you know, bizarrely by surprise. This is a disaster for President Obama's essential strategy of saying Iraq and Afghanistan were two different wars. The Iraq war was the dumb war. I'm going to put an end to that. We're going to leave that. Everyone agrees that my big achievement as far as Iraq is concerned is going to be just to leave. And then we'll focus on the other stuff and try and do some good things in Afghanistan. But Iraq was supposed to be kind of put in a filing cabinet and the door slammed shut, marked, you know, the end of a stupid Bush mistake, finished. And in the process, President Obama left in quite a hurry, and you had this very ugly row that went on between the Iraqi government and the Obama administration in President Obama's first term about whether American troops were going to be left in any numbers in Iraq. And it was quite clear that when the Iraqis played hardball and said that they wouldn't agree to certain things, it didn't really matter that much to this administration. They were perfectly glad to say, you know what, okay, then we're out of here, because they were just going to give a speech, declare victory, or declare that it was good enough and leave. And the problem is that in foreign policy, the other side gets a vote, and they voted that it wasn't over. And America is now being dragged back into this war that President Obama politically, but also militarily, does not want to go back into. He has no good options at this point. But the problem is, what did we see President Obama saying a couple of weeks ago in his big kind of foreign policy set piece speech? His whole vision of the future was America will be, you know, merely cajoling others to do the fighting for it. It'll be America using auxiliaries and allies on the ground, others' boots on the ground, not American boots on the ground. And what did we see this week? We saw division after division of the American-trained Iraqi army, exactly the kind of force that President Obama put his faith in a couple of weeks ago, just taking off their uniforms and running.
Tom, I can't disagree with a single thing David said. And would it have been different if a residual force had been left in Iraq? And I think the Bush administration favored something like 10 to 15,000 troops, but particularly to deal with what David was talking about, and that is being the training and the logistics and everything for the Iraqi army.
Yes. Now, it is true that a status of forces agreement between the U.S. and Iraq did not happen, but it could have happened. I think the administration, as David said, was just so anxious to get out. It was looking for an excuse to get out. And I think from an emotional standpoint, I guess I would say two things. There are hundreds of thousands of American servicemen and servicewomen who are just gnashing their teeth as they see cities where so much American blood and treasure has been shed falling back into the hands of the bad guys. I mean, I think from an emotional standpoint, it's a human tragedy and a diplomatic, at the moment at least, catastrophe. I think the other problem is that the Obama administration seemed to take the position that this was Bush's war, and it wasn't a President Obama's problem. But now the unraveling of Iraq is happening on President Obama's watch. And I think he and the people around him have not paid sufficient attention. And now you have a situation where the insurgents are moving south towards Baghdad. And if Baghdad were to fall to the insurgents, that would be a personal and political calamity of the highest order. It's just another example of how it is very ill-advised to say not our problem, because now it is Obama's problem, mm-hmm. and how he handles it is not only going to affect his legacy, but it's going to affect the outcome of the November midterm election. So I think they haven't had a policy other than neglect, mm-hmm. not benign neglect, just neglect. And now they're going to have to do something more elaborate than sending combat meals and training equipment.
We'll get in a minute, David, to the role of Prime Minister Maliki here, which has not been a good one for sure. But what would if Al-Qaeda forces that seem to be winning in Iraq take over? They get Baghdad. They may not have all of Iraq, but they can set up some kind of a state there. Would this be an Al-Qaeda state in the middle of the Middle East?
Well, there are so many layers of kind of horror to this. So, I mean, the worst thing is this force, the ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, mm-hmm. they're actually so violent towards civilians that Al-Qaeda disowned them. These are the guys that Al-Qaeda can't stomach.
Yeah.
So these are worse than Al-Qaeda. And the problem is that the vision that they have, it's not just it would be bad enough if you had a very violent, extremely militant Islamic group in charge of the center of Iraq. But the problem is this is fundamentally a challenge to the borders of the Middle East drawn by the French and the British at the end of the colonial era. Mm-hmm. If you look at the maps of where ISIS wants their kind of caliphate, it crosses the Syrian-Iraq border. They don't recognize those current borders. Then you would see, you know, potentially, you have the north of Iraq, the Kurdish part of Iraq, which has essentially been functioning as a separate country, friendly to America, friendly to the West, relatively stable up till now, its own oil reserves, itching to break away. Very close. This is within a couple of hours' drive of the fighting, is Erbil. A town full of Western oil companies, mm-hmm. Full of Peshmerga fighters, you know, and then that starts to flow into Turkey, because Turkey have their own Kurds, and Turkey is very keen for Kurdistan not to become a separate mm-hmm. country, because that contests that border. So it would be bad enough if we had a safe haven for extremely, extremely militant, the worst sort of imaginable mm-hmm. Islamic extremists, but they fundamentally challenge and contest the borders on the map. I just think on President Obama, having said he failed to get a better arrangement for leaving American forces there, just to answer the question that you mm-hmm. asked Tom, I'm very skeptical of the arguments, the kind of partisan arguments mm-hmm. raging around Washington this week, where Republicans are pointing at President Obama and saying this is his fault because somehow if there were those 15,000 troops, things would be better. We need to remember that there were at the peak 166,000 American troops at the height of sectarian fighting. So we have kind of tested to destruction the thesis that putting American troops in Iraq stops sectarian fighting.
Well, one thing happened, though, back in 2007, and that was the change in the strategy by those American forces. More were sent in the surge, and they adopted a strategy under General Petraeus that actually made Iraq much more peaceful and stable.
But remember what the strategy was. The mm-hmm. strategy wasn't for America to win those fights. The mm-hmm. strategy was to embrace the Sunni sort of nationalist movement, the awakening, get them to do the fighting. Mm-hmm. So effectively, they managed to harness some of the sectarian flows mm-hmm. and forces in that country in a way that smacked back the forces that America at that time saw as most destructive. But it wasn't at any point, you know, does anyone believe that if you got 150,000 American troops and sent them in tomorrow, Iraq would suddenly stabilize? I mean, I think that the fundamental problem, I mean, my newspaper, The Economist, mm-hmm. we backed the Iraq war.
Yep.
But the fundamental problem is that was a disaster.
It would be difficult for these troops to do it as long as the Maliki government were still in place. Tom, I'll turn to you. The Maliki government is a sectarian government, a Shia government that has provoked what is a centuries-long a feud between the Sunnis and the Shia, and it's turned into a civil war in Iraq that is, we see what's happened. And so discuss Maliki, who seems to have in many ways provoked what goes on.
You talk about politicians who have a tin ear. I think Maliki has retired the trophy on having a complete tin ear, and by that I mean he is not very understanding of the realities here. And every conversation that I know about between President Obama and Maliki and Vice President Joe Biden and Maliki, both Biden and Obama have made the point you have to be a unifier. You have to reach out to your political enemies. There has to be, if not a coalition government, there has to be a sense of unity or there will be no solution. And Maliki has not only ignored that advice, he has rigorously and vigorously ignored that advice. And the result, as you just said, is utterly predictable. He has no base other than his own. He's proven to be a very pathetic leader of a country, and that's part of the problem.
David, what about Iran's role now? If the U.S. doesn't help, what do the Iranians do or are already doing?
Well, in the vacuum left by America's departure from Iraq a couple of years ago, Iran has stepped up. And the fundamental situation, let's not forget, when Saddam Hussein was toppled, and my own newspaper backed that forcefully, and so did I at the time, you had a Sunni minority in charge of a restive kind of majority Shiite country. That's what the deal was.
Indeed.
In toppling Saddam and toppling that Sunni elite, and empowering the Shiite majority in a very fractured country, one of the big things you did was you created an opening for the gigantic Shiite power next door, Iran, which has increasingly become influential in Baghdad. I mean, Nouri al-Maliki is Shiite, and Iran has, you know, an increasingly active role. And America has been increasingly frustrated at things like, you know, even Iraq wouldn't prevent arms flights flying over Iraqi territory, carrying, you know, Iran's weapons around. Iran has now offered, more or less, to come and intervene, to come and help. There are people saying, might that be the least bad option here? I mean, the other problem is we keep talking about Iraq, and that's because that's what's on the map, but this is Iraq and Syria. And I think there is a good argument to be made that people trying to attack Obama for the failure in Iraq are being partially kind of disingenuous, because fundamentally this is an inherited failure from the Bush war of choice. Where I think you can certainly criticize President Obama is his Syria policy, which has been disastrously hands-off, disastrously slow, disastrously reluctant to listen to the people around him crying out for trying to arm more moderate opposition forces a couple of years ago. It is Syria's collapse that is empowering this fight across the border into Iraq. And so he is certainly culpable on that front. But the problem is that at the moment, I can see all kinds of ways in which Obama's mistakes have made things worse, and things he could do now could make things even worse. I struggle to see ways in which we can magically make things much better.
Well, I struggle as well. Tom, what about it? Maliki wants help. He wants American airstrikes. No doubt he would like American troops on the ground, which he's certainly not going to get, I think the Obama administration has made clear. What militarily can the U.S. do that would prevent the insurgents from taking Baghdad, for one thing?
Well, I can't see anything, Fred, other than airstrikes, and the president is going to be very reluctant to do that. I mean, you're right. The White House has vigorously said there will be no American troops on the ground. That is it's a non-starter for President Obama. But Obama is very reluctant to even do airstrikes, because with airstrikes, there is the possibility that aircraft, Navy aircraft, and Air Force planes get shot down and Americans die. And I think the American people have no stomach for that. And so it's got to be something more robust. A Democratic consultant who is very close to the White House and is not privy to what they're talking about said to me the other day, he's going to have to do more than he wants to do, and there's no way around it. But how much more remains to be seen. I think he's going to be very reluctant to do airstrikes.
Yeah, well, he has to do more, but exactly what, of course, is not clear. And time is not on the Obama administration's side at the moment.
These rebel troops are moving smartly, and it's not just insurgents. It's now more or less a real army.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, in contrast to the Iraqi army and security forces that seem to just be fleeing, leaving their weapons, leaving their vehicles, and just running for the desert.
Yeah, and putting on civilian clothes,
but
as you mentioned.
You know, I mean, let's try and understand why that might be. I mean, there was some extraordinary reporting out of Iraq this week from the Reuters news agency. So the ISIS, these extremist fighters, they put videos out to be seen by the Iraqi security forces, showing some fighters arriving at the house of a police colonel in the middle of the night, dragging him out of bed, and then they filmed themselves hacking his head off in his bedroom with a carving knife. And then they showed, the rest of the video shows an army commander from the Sunni sort of militia and his two sons being led out to the desert, being filmed digging their own graves. Then the colonel faces the camera and is forced to say, "I am digging my own graves with my own hands. This is what happens if you defy these extremist fighters." Mm-hmm. Then they're killed and thrown in the graves. Mm. This video put out on the web for people to see. So, you know, sitting comfortably in a studio in Washington, I feel reluctant to criticize these fighters for leaving.
Yeah, I do too. We'll have more in just a minute, but first a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes, of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are David Rennie of The Economist, Tom DeFrank of National Journal, and this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Well, let's turn to the World Cup. I hope I'm not the only one of the three of us who is particularly interested in this, to watch what we call in America soccer, which the rest of the world calls football, but it has begun in Brazil amid some big problems. The first is, and David, I'll call on you in the beginning. We're not going to actually discuss the games. There have only been several, but you have this soccer federation that is headquartered in Switzerland that is most well known for its corruption.
Indeed, there is something about international sporting organizations headquartered in Switzerland that never bodes well. You know, a decade or two ago, it was the Olympic Committee that had, you know, a series of appalling scandals. And now it's the turn of FIFA, the International Federation of Football Associations. Essentially, what you have is a sporting world which generates billions and billions of dollars in revenues, which involves giving power to very rich countries and some very poor countries, and they all get to vote in where the tournaments take place. They all get to vote on the rules of the game, on appointing referees. And unfortunately, that combination of very poor countries and billions of dollars and very rich countries who want to host these tournaments, at every level, we are discovering more and more about the corruption. Mm-hmm. It's there are match-fixing scandals, not directly involving the World Cup, but we've had a series of appalling match-fixing scandals involving mostly Far Eastern, Singaporean, Chinese gamblers paying referees to rig matches in Africa, in Europe. We also have considerable evidence that not this host, Brazil, but the next host of the next World Cup, Qatar, is accused of paying bribes to secure the World Cup in Qatar. And arguably, having the World Cup in Qatar is nuts. I mean, they're building these outdoor stadiums in a place where it's 50 degrees centigrade in the summer, and they're going to have outdoor air conditioning, and a country with no sort of soccer tradition.
Yeah.
But they have this trophy thing of the World, of the World Cup. So it is a kind of appalling collision of gigantic money and poverty. And in Brazil right now, this week, the opening day of the World Cup, we see that collision on the streets in Sao Paulo, one of the largest cities, the commercial capital of Brazil. We saw the police using tear gas on protesters, essentially because their view is we are very poor people in a country which has very unequally shared wealth, and this multi-billion dollar tournament is happening around us. Where is the help for us? And so you have this very unhappy collision between mega money, international sport, and poor countries.
Tom, the protesters make a point. And the point is that Brazil, the government in Brazil, spent over $11 billion to ready the country with the right stadiums and so on to host these 32 teams, including the United States. And they argue that the money could have been better used for education and health care and so on in Brazil. They have a point.
They do have a point. The average annual income in Brazil is about $12,000 a year. And if you're on minimum wage in Brazil, it's about $3,000 a year. And there are lots of places in Brazil where the escalation in housing prices is huge. In Sao Paulo, it's especially acute. Tens of thousands of residents have been forced out of their homes, many of them ramshackle homes, so that the government can build stadiums, at least in Sao Paulo, that aren't even finished for the game. So it really is a collision of rich and poor here. And I think the protests are going to continue all the way through. And they'll get even worse, I should say, if Brazil somehow doesn't win the Cup.
Usually, if it's being held in your country, the home team does very well. Argentina won when it was The other World Cup was in Argentina. France did when it was there, and Brazil, of course, is one of the leading countries in football. No question about that. You know, there was a point made in The Economist that was an interesting one to me, and that is that most of the largest countries in the world, population-wise, the football has not taken off. China, India. India is a big cricket country, of course. Mm-hmm. China, I'm not sure why. Even in the United States, while lots of young people play football, soccer here, it doesn't seem to succeed as a national sport or as a professional sport. I'm not sure what the reason is for this failure. A sport that's been so successful in Latin America and in European countries just is not in these other countries.
I think it's different reasons. I mean, clearly in America you hear people saying that the problem is that you can often have a game where the score is 0-0, 0-0. And if you're American with a culture of kind of instant excitement and instant gratification, that's very unsatisfactory.
Yeah, there's another way of saying, you know, big field, small ball.
And
not much scoring.
And I mean, look at the polar opposite is basketball, where you get scores of, you know, hundreds of points on each side and something happens every 2 seconds. China is an interesting case. Part of it, I think, is, you know, for football to really take off in a poor country, you need a culture where the kids are allowed out to play in the streets after school, just to go down to the park and kind of develop their own love of the game on their own. China is a country where you have, one-child families in very crowded cities, and after school, they are doing their homework. They're doing extra maths. Their parents do not want their kids running in the streets because there isn't a park anyway. They want them doing extra maths to get into college and get a good job.
Was there talk about it in China? Was it?
I was in China as a reporter, so they had a lot of English soccer on television. So Manchester United was a huge thing. David Beckham was a big star in China. So they like to watch it, but Chinese kids are very, very, very carefully controlled. You know, they have these little precious one child in these cities, and the idea of just letting them kind of run in the streets and sort of kick back with a ball on a nice summer evening, that's not the Chinese way.
Well, that's certainly the American way, the European way, the Latin American way, and the Brazilian way. And we'll see 32 teams. This will probably have the biggest audience of any sporting event in the world. And I'll be watching some of it, particularly the American games. But, Tom, I want to ask you, you can comment on this, on the World Cup if you want to, but I wanted to ask you about Republicans. In one of the most amazing primary defeats I've ever heard of, the majority leader from Richmond, Virginia, Eric Cantor, lost to a candidate who spent no money and had a lot of help from talk radio and other things. And I don't think this has had, though immigration was a big issue, it didn't seem to have much impact around the country, but it certainly did on the Republican leadership in Washington.
This is an extraordinary story. Apparently no congressional majority leader has ever had this happen to him. It is a seismic development, and I think the immediate impact is that this is more or less the end of the Obama administration's ability to get much, if anything, done the rest of the way. I think Republicans running for re-election or running in November 2014 are now going to be scared to death of anything that smacks of being what I call a dread moderate. Because the right wing of the Conservative Party is clearly in the ascendancy, and anybody who appears to be willing to do any kind of business with the Obama administration, no matter how modest or no matter how much the issue calls out for bipartisanship, is going to be in serious, serious trouble. And that, I think, is what the lesson is politically of this.
Yeah, Obama has said he doesn't much want to do business with Republicans anyway, because he thinks that they are just opposed to everything he said.
I mean, that's, you know, it's a little bit sneaky. I mean, it suits him to have Republicans looking extreme, but there are things that he would like to get done.
He'd like to get done, but he said he will do things on his own through executive
but
orders.
Because he knows that he's not going to get any help from Republicans in Congress. I mean, it seems to me that the fundamental story here is you had this guy, Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in the House of Representatives. His problem was that he was trying to do two things at once. He was trying to be the right-wing insurgent who's sort of running a purity contest, and he was ambitious and wanted to hold the top job in the House of Representatives and become a big Washington player. And it turns out you can't be the purity insurgent and the Washington ambitious power player. And I think that straddle kind of finally, you know, that splits came apart on him.
There is a phrase that is used by people who are critical of Republicans or Democrats in Washington, and that is they've gone Washington. In other words, they're ignoring their roots. And Eric Cantor, who, after all, I know Eric, Eric Cantor. He's not a moderate. He's actually
very
conservative. And yet he was blamed of having gone Washington, even though his district in some parts is about 50 miles from Washington. Richmond, where he lives, is about 100 miles.
That's right. But I mean, I think the lesson for the Republican Party, the broader one, is if you set up a purity contest, you will lose. There will always be someone purer than you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're in this very dangerous kind of scenario now where their base, their core voters are so mm-hmm. angry mm-hmm. and so unwilling to accept President Obama as a legitimate mm-hmm. leader of the country that, you know, that rage is just scorching all in its path.
Well, it really hasn't. I would dissent in one way, and I'll ask Tom about this. You can talk about it too, David. And that is that in so many of the primary elections, the voters most angry at their Republican leadership, their candidates have lost. Now, a great exception is what just happened to Eric Cantor in Virginia.
Exactly. The other thing is there's a sidebar to this situation is that the college professor who beat Cantor not only railed about the Obama administration and Republicans who were too moderate, he also talked about Republicans who were cozy with Wall Street. It was there's a populist streak to this message. And at one point, it almost sounded like he was talking about the Democrats. So we'll have to see just how angry the country is. Mm-hmm. I think this suggests that maybe the country is angrier about incumbents of all political stripes than we suspect. And we'll know in the first Tuesday in November.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric Cantor did spend a considerable amount of time in New York raising money for Republicans from Wall Street, as Democrats do, too. But and that I think that contributed. Well, on that negative note for Republicans, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.